I'm very happy now to welcome back to the show Lois Rudnick. She's a cultural historian, she's a biographer, and her new book is called The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture. Welcome.
Thank you so much, and you were able to say that all in one breath.
Is this supposed to be a tongue twister?
It is.
That's funny. Anyway, Lois will be speaking this Friday, the 24th of August, at 5:30 at the New Mexico Museum of Art. That's a slideshow and lecture. And she will be speaking again on Tuesday, the 4th of September, at 6 in the evening at Collected Works Bookstore. These are both free events. So lots of stuff about Mabel Dodge Lujan, whom you've been studying for a very long time.
Yes, for over 35 years, Mary Charlotte, and I'm not asking anyone to put me on a couch to find out why.
Yeah, well, I'm going to ask you why at some point. But first of all, there are many people who have heard of her and know something about her, but also many who have not. Who was this woman, Mabel Dodge Lujan?
Well, in a brief summary, Mabel Ganson Evans Dodge Stern Lujan, to give you her maiden and her four married names, was born... Four married names, yes. Was born into a wealthy Gilded Age family, sort of in the middle of the Victorian era in the 1880s, grew up in Buffalo, married at 21. Her husband was killed in a hunting accident about a year after they were married. She had just had a baby, and she was also having an affair with a prominent Buffalo doctor at the time, which became one of the great scandals of the city. Her mother eventually broke it off after 3.5 years, sent her to Europe, where on the boat she met Edwin Dodge, who would become her second husband, and whom she agreed to marry if he promised to give her her life of beauty. And he did, took her to Florence, bought her a Medician villa, and Mabel decided that she would use this venue to help recreate the Renaissance, which she believed in 1905 when she moved there was probably the most wonderful time in human history. So she brought all kinds of famous actors and actresses and theater people and writers and poets like Eleanor Duse and Gordon Craig to her villa. And she lived there, owned it, and entertained these folk until about 1912. She had just met Gertrude Stein in Paris. Gertrude Stein had come to stay at the villa, and Stein, who was about the most avant-garde writer in English in the world at the time, living in Paris, though she's an American, convinced Mabel that the past was dead, that the Renaissance was more than dead, that she, as a mercurial American woman who loved to change her clothes and her identity and persona every day, depending upon whatever mood she woke up with in the morning, should go back to America and lead the modern world that was coming into being. Mabel listened to her, left the villa, moved to New York at the edge of Greenwich Village, started one of the most famous and infamous radical salons in American history, entertaining the likes of Emma Goldman and Big Bill Haywood, who was head of the Wobblies, IWW, an anarchist labor union group. Modern artists, painters, Margaret Sanger spoke about birth control there. Some of the first public lectures on Freudian analysis were given there. There wasn't a social, political, cultural topic that wasn't discussed. Free love, free sex, new roles for equality for men and women, social justice for the United States. Her free speech movement, as she called it, would bring in a brave new world. She got a doctor's note to get her husband out of the apartment, saying that he was making her ill, so dear Edwin left. And she took John Reed, 6 years younger, as her lover, a bohemian poet who would become the founder of one of the first communist parties in the United States and is buried in the Kremlin. And she lived a kind of new woman life in the village. She became nationally known as a woman who could do anything, who was in charge of her life, who could live with anyone, love anyone publicly. And by 1915-16, as World War I is breaking out, and by 1917, when the United States enters World War I, she and many of her radical friends are very disillusioned. She moves out to Croton on Hudson to get back to nature and away from the city. She meets the man who's going to become her third husband, post-impressionist painter Maurice Stern, and they have a tempestuous love affair for 2 years. Before, because he's always eyeing other women, and she wants him to be faithful. This is a problem she has throughout her married and unmarried life.
Well, it's not just faithful. She wants to own them.
Yeah, she wants to own them. And in Maurice's case, it was she was tired of his painting and she wanted him to become a sculptor. So she decided that if she married him, which she did in August 1917, that would help her gain her goal. And as soon as they were married, she sent him out west. He went on a honeymoon to Santa Fe alone. And she gave him letters of introduction. She'd seen the Tao Society of Artists show that had come to New York on a circuit show in 1917 for the first time, fell in love with an Indian painting. Maurice writes her the letter that changes the rest of her life in November of 1917. Dearest, you must come out here and save the Indians and show their art and culture to the world. She does. She decides that Santa Fe is too crowded. Moves up to Taos within 2 weeks of arriving, January 1st, 1918.
And there were, what, probably 20,000 people here or something?
Well, there were probably something. There were like 16,000 people in Santa Fe and I think maybe 6,000 in Taos.
Right.
You know, the surrounding the village and in the town itself. And she rents rooms from a notorious man named Manby, who will later be found beheaded and eaten by his dogs in 1929, but that's another story.
Good heavens.
She goes out to the Pueblo. She meets Tony. They are fated. He says he's seen her in a dream. She has also seen him in a dream when his face wiped out Maurice's face before she left New York.
Tony Lujan.
And 9 months in August of 1918, Tony shows her the land on which she's going to build her last house, or one of her many last houses, but they're all in the Taos area. She sends Maurice home and says goodbye to him, and she and Tony move in together. And she begins to build the house. It starts off as a modest farmhouse they purchased from the Trujillos and turns into an 18-room estate, 1,200-foot gatehouse over the years, 5 guest houses. And she begins a utopian dream to build a community in Taos and bring the greatest writers, thinkers, and artists of the world to New Mexico to celebrate the Pueblo Indian way of life, which she believes will end militarism, imperialism, individuality, and materialism in the United States. So she brings the likes of Ansel Adams to photograph Martha Graham, who does some of her first original dance choreography based on what she sees in New Mexico, Leopold Stokowski, Georgia O'Keeffe, who makes her first visit to Taos in 1929, and D.H. Lawrence. Perhaps she's most famous for bringing D.H. Lawrence to New Mexico. And she brings them. Most of these writers and artists do extraordinary work. John Maron produces 100 paintings in 2 summers that he stays with her that really celebrates the land and its beauties and the beauties of the cultures. She never, of course, creates her utopian community because there's always dissension. There's always Mabel trying to control what's going on and intervening in people's lives, sometimes in beneficent ways, sometimes in rather ugly and unfortunate ways. But it does become an extraordinary space, and she does put Taos on the map nationally as an important cultural space.
So we're talking to Lois Rudnick about the suppressed memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan. Now, what about the unsuppressed memoirs? She wrote it.
Well, Mabel wrote 20 volumes of memoirs. She used those volumes. Some of them were not intended to be published until after death. And she published in the 1930s 4 volumes of her life story, beginning with her childhood in Buffalo, going through her European experiences, her time in New York. And very interestingly to me, though I didn't know this when I wrote her biography, ending her final volume after 1,600 pages, we're at a moment when she and Tony are about to have their first sexual encounter. And that's the last page of Edge of Taos Desert, her most popular memoir. And I never thought to myself, why does she decide to end the memoirs before she and Tony have sexual relations?
It can't be that she values her own privacy, because we know every single detail of everything to a fault.
Well, we thought we did, but as her biographer, I found out, I discovered when I was doing my research on her in the 70s and 80s, that a substantial number of her papers had been taken out of the archive and put under restriction.
By whom?
Well, the story goes like this. It's the beginning of my book, so but I guess I can give it away.
Yes.
According to Ellen Bradbury, one of our Santa Fe, well-known Santa Fe residents, who was in the Beinecke doing research on Mabel.
The Beinecke Rare Books Library.
Beinecke Rare Book Library at Yale. With Emily Hahn, who was under contract to Houghton Mifflin to write a biography of Mabel. They were looking at some of the manuscripts before any of them had been restricted. And Emily Hahn apparently shouted the word or spoke the word syphilis loudly in the reading room. And one has to understand that one is barely supposed to breathe in the Beinecke Library reading room, let alone shout the word syphilis so that every head in the room turns toward you. They called over the curator. He saw the material. He called Mabel's son, John Evans, and said, "Do you want scholars reading this?" And John Evans wrote him a letter in April of 1973 saying, "I authorize you to put under lock and key until the year 2000 any manuscript that you think in any way deals with issues of sexuality or sexual disease related to my mother." And so he did. And I came along 4 months later.
Oh, man, if she'd only kept her mouth shut.
So when the papers were open, allowed to be open in the year 2000, I went down out of curiosity just to see what I missed. I didn't intend to ever write another book on Mabel. I had edited her published memoirs down to a svelte 250 pages from the original 1600 in 1999.
That must have been a task.
It was so easy, I can't tell you.
Really?
Yes. I know her so well after living with her all these years that it took me several hours to do it. That is all.
What?
It took me 10 years to write this new book, but it took me just several hours to edit her published memoirs. They were very editable. Yeah. I don't know why, but I just knew what to take out.
There were probably some gems.
There were gems, and I knew what the gems were, and I knew what was where people just didn't need to know that because it went on and on. She always needed a good editor, as I've often said, and she found one in me. So I started to read these papers, and I flipped out. In fact, I'd seen one of the memoirs even before I came down in 2000. For some reason, had been opened. Called the last memoir she wrote in 1954, called 50 Years of Doctors I Have Known. Doctors, 50 Years of Experience, excuse me. And in that essay, she talks about the fact that three of her four husbands had syphilis, that she contracted it from Tony for the first time in a visible way in terms of it manifesting symptoms.
So and she had... Her third husband is the one who gave her syphilis?
Her fourth husband.
I mean, I forget about the first one because he died so quickly. But
he's the only one who didn't have syphilis.
So the three major husbands who didn't die 15 minutes after they got married all had syphilis, but she didn't get it from the first two?
She did not get it from the first two who had it because it turns out, according to an infectious disease doctor who was one of the people I interviewed about this, a woman has a 1 in 2 chance of contracting syphilis if she has sexual intercourse with someone who has the disease. Now, that's a guesstimate. That is not a refined study that's been done. But she said those statistics are probably true on average, that it's 1 out of 2 times. It could have been that the syphilis was in remission. Edwin Dodge was receiving mercury treatments, which was the treatment du jour in the early 20th century before Salverson, which came around 1910, and was an arsenical compound that prevented the disease from progressing from its first stage to second and third stage.
So arsenic-based.
Yes, so toxic.
Yeah.
And well, given intravenously.
Right, right. Now, what did syphilis mean culturally at that time? I mean, the book is interesting to me because reading it as somebody who grew up in well into the second half of the 20th century, you have such different point of departure than somebody who was born in 1879.
Right.
And one of the things, I mean, we learned about syphilis and gonorrhea in sex ed class in public school, and they were curable by antibiotics.
Right, by penicillin.
End of story.
Right, exactly.
But in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, it was a whole different story. I mean, that had a cultural meaning, and it was...
Right, and the cultural meaning went way back, well before the time that Mabel was born. The best circumstantial evidence suggests that syphilis was a gift of the Native Americans to Columbus and his crew. I don't know if Columbus had it, but it appears for the first time virulently in modern times after the return of Columbus's second voyage in 1493, I believe.
So and it was either Columbus or one of his...
It was the sailors had contracted it, presumably from the Indians. There were earlier versions of syphilis that have been found in the bones of earlier Europeans many centuries before the 15th century, but the first modern manifestation happens after the return of his second voyage. And the outbreak all over Europe is quick and virulent. People can die within a few days. They manifest horrific symptoms, like the plague, very much like the Black Plague. And every country calls it by the name of its enemy. So the English call it the French disease, the French call it the English disease, the Italians call it the Spanish call it the Italian disease. It's quite wonderful. You know, NIMBY, not in my backyard. And there is a incredible discourse that grows up around syphilis because it is so virulent. It dies down after several decades, so that people can, for example, contract syphilis and not necessarily go beyond the first stage to secondary, tertiary syphilis, which second stage can be anywhere from a few months to the several years into your life. The worst kind of syphilis a person can experience, about one-third of those who contracted syphilis before penicillin became available in 1946, moved on to the tertiary stage, which has hideous systemic problems. And, you know, heart, it affects your heart, it affects your brain. There's something called syphilitic paresis, insanity, as they called it then, which was created by the syphilis. The joints, the bones, everything in the body essentially is under attack in the most horrific ways, and one dies from this, usually.
And so syphilis was not only feared, but also there were all sorts of moral overtones.
Oh, incredible moral overtones. There's a Pope Leo XII I talk about in my book, banned condoms in 1823, not because they prevented conception, but because they prevented syphilitics from giving each other the disease and suffering deservedly. Luther railed about syphilitics.
That's really mean.
It's just, these prostitutes who are poisoning our society should be put upon a wheel of fire and destroyed. Women, typically the people who were blamed for spreading it, were poor women, working class women, prostitutes, homosexuals, and Jews. There's a chapter in Hitler's Mein Kampf about the ways in which Jews are spreading syphilis throughout Europe in the 20th century. So there's a huge cultural opprobrium. We don't have good statistics on the number of people who died, because just as with AIDS, doctors who were the doctors of respectable middle and upper class families would not write syphilis as cause of death. They would write something else, like pneumonia or some other disease that did not have cultural, you know, really serious cultural opprobrium associated with it. But the guesstimates are that it was a pandemic until penicillin, that, you know, a substantial percentage of men and women contracted syphilis. The historian that I worked, whose work I most used in my book, Alan Brandt, who wrote the best social history of venereal disease in the U.S., suggests that somewhere between 15% and 50% of men in the pre-penicillin days might have been afflicted with gonorrhea and syphilis. Many more with gonorrhea than with syphilis. The statistics are much smaller, but these are guesstimates because it just isn't good data for this. So when Mabel was growing up, the Victorian euphemism was, "The sins of the fathers shall be visited upon the children unto the third and fourth generation." And that comes from the second commandment of the Ten Commandments that Moses purportedly brought down from the mountain. And what it did was to express a Victorian idea that was both moral and medical. That is, it wasn't just terrible if you contracted syphilis and then gave it to your wife, but it could manifest two or three generations later in your children and grandchildren. That is not true medically, but that is what they believed. And of course, they believed it was justified if you not. If they believed it was justified if you had to suffer and but those who you passed it on to, of course, were completely innocent. So the first play about syphilis, for example, on the public stage by Henrik Ibsen, Ghosts, 1881, it's the first time that syphilis is ever represented on the on a public stage. Incredibly controversial play, especially in England. And there, a young man in his 20s suddenly begins to manifest tertiary syphilis. His father had syphilis and passed it on to him. That can't happen. Women can pass syphilis onto their babies in a form known as congenital syphilis. Babies can be born deaf. They can be born with all kinds of birth defects. They can be born, with several different kinds of problems. But a child who's grown up to become a teenager, 20s, 30s, cannot suddenly show manifestations of syphilis because their father or mother had their mother had it and passed it on to them. But that was the belief at the time. It wasn't until the late 19th century that middle-class doctors began to feel that women were innocent victims. That is, middle-class white and upper-class women. Women of color, working-class women, of course, were spreading the disease everywhere. And
men weren't spreading it?
No. This is what one of the most interesting things I discovered in my research is that even the most progressive doctors did not want husbands who contracted syphilis from prostitutes. And, of course, men were supposed to spread their wild oats before they married, and that's how they often contracted it. They did not want them to tell their wives because they were so fearful that the upper middle class white Anglo-Saxon American home would be destroyed by this information. And this moral panic around syphilis at this time in the States is also deeply connected to our largest era of mass immigration in U.S. history until modern times.
Right.
And, of course, many of these doctors believe that the immigrants were spreading syphilis and diseasing both the body politic as well as the pure, chaste, pristine Christian bodies of white women.
The idea that the purity, the concept or myth could survive through that many people spreading sexually transmitted diseases to each other in every level of society.
Yep.
And the idea that, I mean, it's sort of like the way people see prostitution now, you know, it's they never arrest the men
right.
who are going after 14-year-old prostitutes, but
right.
they'll arrest the 14-year-old.
Right.
It's
exactly.
the same, it's like that same mentality that somehow, first of all, there is monogamy and purity and goodness,
right.
and that's the norm,
right.
and people stick to that. And then if that's not happening, then somehow it's women's fault.
Exactly. And one of the things, there were so many things I discovered. What happened, I sort of stopped at the point where I was reading these papers and got interested. When I read that paper that Mabel wrote about the number of men who had syphilis whom she married, I started, and the last line of that memoir is, how could there be this much venereal disease in the world? And that sentence got me going for 5 or 6 years to try to figure out what were the social and cultural impacts of venereal disease on Western Europe and the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century. And it impacted everything, Mary Charlotte. I mean, not just immigration policy, not just attitudes toward prostitutes, not just the social purity movement to get people to be chaste and just say no to sex. Does it sound familiar? So that it would not be spread. There are resonances with our contemporary times,
right.
but it affected the women's rights movement. You know, the most prominent radical feminist in England wrote a book called The Great Scourge and How to End It, arguing that British women should be given the right to vote because their men were polluting the race. And the only way they could control the sexual disease that was rampantly destroying, and she meant by that the Anglo-Saxon race, of course, was if women got the vote to fight it. Charlotte Perkins Gilman, a famous feminist writer in the States in the 1910s, wrote a book called The Crux about a heroine who is about to marry a man who has both gonorrhea and syphilis, and is saved by a woman doctor whose reproductive life had been destroyed by being married to a man with gonorrhea. So there was a whole there was a whole slew of new women novels in England and the United States about the issues of venereal disease. So it impacted the women's rights movement, it impacted immigration reform, it impacted modern art and modern literature.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about her new book, The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture. Now, we've talked about sex and syphilis. We haven't talked about psychoanalysis. Mabel, I mean, you know, and this is something we really do need to get you on the couch for a moment, and I don't know how.
Okay, I'm going to start. I'll lean in the chair. You can pretend I'm on a couch.
I don't know how you stuck with this woman for 35 years, because she's driving me nuts as I read this. I mean, she's hard to take.
She's
so self-involved. She's so controlling.
Right?
She's so unhappy. She's so full of herself.
Yes.
In a way that doesn't convince me. It might convince a lot of other people. But basically, she was a mess. And you feel bad because she had kind of awful parents who really didn't
right.
pay attention to her, take care of her.
Right.
And they hated each other passionately.
Yes, they did.
But still, I mean, so she comes out, what, manic depressive?
Well, she was manic depressive. I mean, I don't want to use this label to explain everything about her life. She was diagnosed, I don't know by whom, probably by her first psychoanalyst, Smith Eli Jelliff, as manic depressive. But it does help to explain these extraordinary mood swings that she had between high mania, and those are, you know, it was during those moments that she often had she often dreamed up these ideas of creating these utopian communities that would transform the world. At the center of that was a profound narcissism, which you can understand would come along with a psychological disability that would take you to the highest heights and make you think you could create anything. And as an aside, manic depression manifests way more frequently in artists and writers and artistic geniuses than it does in the regular, quote-unquote, population. And then these hideous depressions where you felt like you were completely empty and the world around you was Black Death. I never took either the syphilis or the manic depression seriously when I wrote her biography. Maybe I was too mentally healthy. I don't know.
Well, but that would be a nice way of thinking.
She was very open about both of them. And one of the things that reading the new work has helped me to have tremendous respect for, as difficult and dark as her life was, at least as I'm presenting it in this book, you know, her creative life I've presented in several other books, this really focuses on the internal Sturm und Drang of her illnesses and her mental illnesses and her physical illnesses and her relationship with Tony Lujan. One of the things I've really come to appreciate after reading her letters to her psychiatrists and understanding that there was nothing you could do for manic depression until the 1960s when lithium became available, that, you know, this is a woman who writes in her published memoirs about trying to commit suicide over and over again. And I never understood why. I just didn't get it. You know, why is this woman marrying men who have syphilis? Now, Edwin tells her before they're married. Maurice finds out under psychoanalysis. I don't know if she married him after she found out, but I'm guessing she did. Tony, she may have married him before he infected her. She may not have. I can't figure out the date of that. But one of the things that just struck me as very powerful and moving about her life and her story is that she's living with a Victorian idea that she is doomed to suffer for the sins of her father. So her father may have been syphilitic, I don't know for sure. In some ways, her marrying men with this disease is a form of self-punishment. And she's also the most modern of modern women who thinks that she can sleep with anyone and that sex, because she's learned this from Freud, that a woman who is sexually expressive and is amused to men of genius and is a mother, which she was never good at, even though she wanted to have many more children, would fulfill herself, you know, become the woman she was supposed to become if she just followed these prescriptions. And none of these prescriptions ever made her happy. In some ways, I see her as an extreme of tensions and conflicts that women within her generation, and I would say some women, many women still in our generation, go through around what it means to be a real woman. And for many women still, to be a real woman means to be sexually attractive to another man. Mabel experimented with, had several lesbian relationships and affairs. She gave those up because it was really clear to her that she was never going to gain any kind of power by having women as lovers. And because Freud, of course, and other psychoanalysts and psychiatrists pointed to homosexuality as a form of arrested development. That is not who she wanted to be.
I know. And what's so funny is, I mean, you write about this in the book, and it's one of those things about Freud, homosexuality is infantile and arrested development. And then you read these things that Mabel herself writes about how when her husband decides to leave the house for 45 minutes, she throws herself at him and says, "Don't leave me, don't leave me. As if she were a 2-year-old. When you talk about arrested development, I was like, Mabel, you should have stayed with the ladies.
Well, I think that she might have been much happier had she stayed with the ladies. Part of that, she's very clear about knowing that she's showing what a fool she was when she writes about herself, Mary Charlotte. When critics condemned in the 1930s during the Great Depression, the left eviscerated her memoirs. You know, these are the memoirs of a bourgeois woman who, you know, represents everything that created the Great Depression. I mean, some of them were outrageously ridiculous in their statements. She writes to Leo Stein, Gertrude's brother, and says, "The whole point of this memoir was to show people what a mess I was and how people should not be this, how people could learn not to be this way and needed to be able to live creatively and healthily and wholly mentally in the world outside. I was not trying to disguise the kind of person I was," and she was that kind of person for much of the rest of her life, although the other side of her was this empowering, creative, philanthropic person who brought incredible people together and created marvelous synergistic spaces of creativity. So there's a creative and a destructive element in her, partly related to the manic depression, partly related to some people adopted Freud. Mabel was going to have the first Freudian baby. Anything she adopted, it was going to be to the nth degree. I mean, the letters, if you read the letter she wrote to Jelliffe, and I always love to read that first, the first one that's in the book, saying, you know, "Now I know how to be a real woman. I have to lie still under the phallus. I have to be completely passive. And so I'm going to have the first psychoanalytic baby because I've learned not to try to be a male and be aggressive." So not only did her Victorian background train her to be a woman who would know her place beside a man and show him off or beside great creative geniuses, but Freud, who was deeply Victorian, Freudianism reinforced some of the worst elements of Victorianism in terms of gender issues.
Right.
And she had a kind of double whammy. You know, one of the other things I realized doing this research is that the Victorian era didn't just die and the modern era start. And, of course, nothing ever works like that anyway. We just give these, you know, categorical names to create moments in history that we can talk about. But that much of what was problematic about the Victorian infiltrated its way into the early modern era. I mean, Freud was a Victorian patriarchal guy who wanted women to know their place. He did think they should enjoy sexuality. That was different from what many of the Victorians said. But she bought into him, and she believed, okay, this is what I have to do. And it was completely against her nature, her personality, her desires. She never believed she could be a creator in her own right. And I've often felt, in defense of her, that women who did this kind of work as a cultural catalyst, salon hostesses, people who created networks for people in politics and culture, were kind of never until recent years given their due because they didn't have a product. They didn't have a book. They didn't have a painting. They didn't have a sculpture or something that you could put a label on and give a value to. But that work is incredibly important.
We're talking to Lois Rudnick about Mabel Dodge Lujan. I think that when you have those kinds of what look to us now like ridiculous stereotypes about men and women, where a man has to be ridiculously strong and not sensitive, and a woman has to be ridiculously weak and have no identity except the man, who by definition is never going to reciprocate because he's ridiculously strong and insensitive.
Well put, Mary Charlotte.
Well, I mean, so you have a setup for culture-wide, society-wide, multinational unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of see why Mabel found something that was missing when she came to New Mexico, mm-hmm. and met Taos Indians who didn't presumably subscribe
right.
to the, all those stereotypes.
Well, in fact, one of the many, many ironies of her life is that the appeal of Tony Lujan, he definitely was strong and manly, but he was extremely gentle and in some ways what we might call, from a Western culture point of view, traditional Western culture point of view, feminine. Because he was kind, he was gentle. There's a story she tells in Edge of Taos Desert where he brings her the first roses of spring and she tosses them on the ground because she's busy doing something else. And she realizes after he leaves what she's done, that for him this was an incredibly important gesture of love. This is not a man who has much to give her in the way of anything material, which is one of the things she actually does love about him. And she realizes just how unfeeling she is, and that he shows her a way of being that seems to her much healthier than her way of being. The fact that he was sexually active with other women throughout their married life drove her crazy. And
but
that's
she
one
wasn't
of the,
sleeping with him either.
Well, she wasn't. If she's telling the truth, after he infected her with syphilis, they stopped having sexual relations. As far as I know, she never slept with another man. I can't say for sure. We know that Tony had many mistresses and had affairs with women of different cultures and races. And for him, it was nothing. It meant nothing about, he loved Mabel, and this was sex. It was a whole different view of sex than she had. For her, one of the reasons she clung to him every time he left the house, and some of those episodes are described in ways that are absolutely hilarious. He says, you know, you're tearing my pants. Would you just let go already? I'll be back later.
Only he says it so neutrally.
He does. He's at no affect. It's just hysterical. It's very funny. I mean, and I think it's meant to be funny, actually, the way she wrote it.
So.
Oh, no, it was. No, it was, definitely. Is that she knows that Tony often went off at night, and he's not going to tell her that he's going off to see another woman. So she had reason. It wasn't just paranoia to fear that. And she could not understand how you could be sexually with another person and not love them and want to leave the other person. She couldn't understand how you could have multiple sexual partners. She never did. Serial monogamy, one thing. Multiple sexual partners and being married is another thing. She did not do that.
What did Tony Lujan see in her?
That is a much harder question to answer because he left no written records. He was barely literate. My assumption is that he was not... He was already someone who'd spent a lot of time going outside Taos Pueblo. He'd gone all over the Southwest to collect songs. He'd worked as a model. I think he was genuinely attracted to her. They were both genuinely attracted to each other in some deep way that is hard to articulate. But he also, through her, achieved an enormous amount of power, social power, cultural power,
money.
Political capital, money, Cadillacs, trips to New York, trips to Mexico, trips to California, meeting incredibly interesting people, some of whom thought he was a joke and some of whom took him extremely seriously. Her women friends like O'Keefe and Mary Austin loved, and Willa Cather loved Tony. Some of the men made fun of him, you know, this big Indian playing his drum and riding around in his Cadillac kind of thing. He was, from everything I know and everything I know about Tony, I know through Mabel, so it's a very skewered perspective.
Yeah. Well, weren't there other people who talked about
they
him
did,
besides
but
her?
There were people who wrote about meeting him, but they never really said enough to give you any idea of who he really was internally. And I feel as though, if you know the painting Cui Bono in the New Mexico Museum of Arts, that Taos Indian is standing wrapped in a white summer sheet,
right?
And he's completely in the sunlight, invisible, but he is not letting you in at all. He's just saying, you know, you can paint me, but there's no way you're getting inside me or you're going to know me.
Right.
I feel that in some ways Tony was unknowable even to Mabel, and that he kept, because he was a reserved person and partly because of the culture in which he grew up, he never told her anything he wasn't supposed to tell her about Indians, as far as I can tell. She wrote a, you know, she wrote a book in which she claimed she was telling secrets, but nothing she told in that book was anything people don't already know. So I think he loved her genuinely, but that he also gained a kind of stature that would have been impossible within the social world of the Pueblo that he was living in, the Taos Pueblo.
Did Mabel Dodge Lujan eventually chill out at all?
Well, she had her moments when she was chilled. I think by the 1940s and 50s, much of the Sturm und Drang was over. You know, she and Tony drank a lot. They stayed home much more. She had a lot of different ailments, diabetes. She had serious cataracts as she
syphilis.
Got older. The syphilis never, as far as I can tell, the syphilis she contracted never went beyond the primary stage because they received treatment over at least a year constantly. They received double treatment, mercury ointment and Salverson. So she lived to be 84. She died of a cerebral hemorrhage. There's no evidence that I don't think anyone did an autopsy. And I think that her later life as a grandmother was a little bit calmer. You know, she sort of falls off the map nationally by the 1950s. And she dies in 1962. One of my favorite stories about my first discovering Mabel when I was a graduate student is that when I got my doctoral dissertation, I had a party and I asked all my friends to dress up as their favorite characters in American history and literature.
Nice.
Great. And I was Mabel. And my cousins, who had been hearing about Mabel for years, bought me a t-shirt that said Mabel Who and her name was spelled wrong. And I thought, well, there it is. M-A-B-L-E, a lot of people spell her name that way. So she had really fallen off the map by the time I came upon her. And I think that in her last years, she was chilled out sometimes by alcohol more than just calmness.
Mabel left so much behind in terms of written material, and she, as you say, was a philanthropist, and she organized a lot of things, and she was instrumental in the passage of a bill that did help the Taos Indians. Mm-hmm. And was she, in your view, was she a good writer? Is her work something that we should be reading?
I think that she was a very mixed bag as a writer. Edge of Taos Desert is a beautifully written book. Her memoirs have extraordinary moments of power, both in terms of illuminating women's lives, the political world, and the cultural world that she grew up in. I think her first memoir of growing up in Buffalo, The Child of Rich, Miserable Parents, is one of the best memoirs ever written by a wealthy American woman, on a par with Edith Wharton's autobiography, and they're peers. Wharton's a little bit older than she is. There are extraordinary passages and movers and shakers. A book about her radical years, where she allowed it's a multivocal book, we say in academia. That is, there are many, many times when she lets ordinary people who wrote her letters, poets, philosophers, you know, she gives them a voice in the book. She quotes from their works. She gives you such a strong sense, such an amazing sense of the diversity and richness and sometimes craziness of Greenwich Village, radical Greenwich Village before the war. Her European book is really fantasiacal, women on the salon couch fainting, hilarious stories about expatriate royalty, English aristocrats who've run off with their valets. I mean, there are just phenomenal stories about writers, poets, emigre artists in that book. She overwrote. She could be very histrionic, but at her best, she's a wonderful writer. Winter in Taos, which is not usually included in her other memoirs, is a book she wrote about Taos in through the four seasons, is a beautifully written book. I've met hundreds of people who've read Winter in Taos and Edge of Taos Desert, which has been republished many, multiple times and has sold probably 30,000 copies at this point in paperback, who have told me how much they love her work. Allie McGraw says that she gives a copy of Edge of Taos Desert to everyone who comes to Santa Fe that she knows.
Okay.
So I think at her best, she was a great writer. She certainly wasn't, the greatest writer in the early 20th century. I don't think that is her significance. But I do think what she wrote about and how she tells the story of the times in which she lived makes for very interesting cultural history and gender history and sexual history.
As, again, a woman who was born, you know, a little less than a century later.
Right.
I read this thinking about the place of women, you know, my generation,
right,
your generation, people younger than I. And what do we have to contend with that they didn't?
Right.
And what did they have to contend with that we
right.
have it easier than they did? And one of the things I think that we have it easier is our sense of identity, this whole thing about I'm so weak and I depend on my whole existence from a man, you know.
Right. Which she never really did, even though she said it.
Oh, she did.
She didn't, though. She did a million other things. But she always needed to have a man
but
to justify herself.
Yeah, exactly.
Emotionally, absolutely, Mary Charlotte.
But and so that whole, I guess it's really kind of like a place where you can, as a woman reading it now or as a man reading it now, think, how far have we come? How is
right.
it the same? How is it different? And I ended up sort of feeling like the problems that we have to deal with as women is the fact that the system is stacked against us, that basically the military industrial complex is owned by a bunch of dudes mm-hmm. and, you know.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
And they really, when push comes to shove, they don't listen to us or very many of us. Whereas with her, it was a much deeper, like, what is my value?
Right. But there are, interestingly enough, there are political movements going on today that remind me of some of the worst issues of the culture in which she grew up. I mean, we have a Tea Party, and we have congressmen elected by that Tea Party who are defunding Planned Parenthood, who are still fighting sex education in the schools. You might have had sex education in the schools because you grew up in the liberal, you know, Johnson and post-Johnson era when the feminist movement and the various civil rights movements were at their peak and the anti-war movement and student movement was at its peak. But in some ways, we've gone backwards. We've gone backwards economically, as many of the best economic historians are writing today. It is like we are living in what is like another Gilded Age in terms of the huge discrepancies between the enormous wealth of the top 1% and the other 99%, to use the current phrase.
And the top
phrase,
1/10 of 1%.
And the top who have made the most money over the last 20 years. So we've gone backwards in terms of the idea of a social contract that's inclusive of everyone. I mean, there are congressmen who want to investigate women's bodies before they authorize them to have birth control.
Right.
I mean, it is absolutely incredible to me, the anti-homosexual movement among Tea Party people, the really misogynistic ideas about women that are certainly not permeating the entire culture but are part of our political culture and have much more power than the actual numbers they represent
right.
are frightening.
And it goes back to that era.
And it goes back to that era.
Lois Rudnick is a cultural historian. She's a biographer. She is the author of the new book, The Suppressed Memoirs of Mabel Dodge Lujan, Sex, Syphilis, and Psychoanalysis in the Making of Modern American Culture. And she will be speaking at the New Mexico Museum of Art this Friday, the 24th of August at 5:30, doing a slideshow and talk. And then she will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Tuesday, the 4th of September. That's the day after Labor Day, at 6 in the evening. Both events are free. Oh, and I would like to add that while most people to promote their book have flyers, you have condoms.
I do, Mary Charlotte.
They're printed with the cover of the book on them.
Yes, indeed. Cherry red condoms with the book cover on the plastic casing, completely pure. And the purpose of this, of course, is to sell books, but also at the same time to sell safe sex. If I'm going to write a book about syphilis, I think it's really important that I promote my book in a way that will help people.
Only you. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.